All right, welcome. So I want to offer a short talk around the refuges and precepts, and then we'll move right into the ceremony. So refuges and precepts, this is an annual ceremony that we've been doing for probably decades at this point. And it's such a lovely way to start a year. It's also a way we often start retreats. And some people start each day by chanting these refuges and precepts. And why is that? Why do we begin that kind of beginnings of the year, the retreat of the day? One of the core reasons for this is around dukkha, around suffering. Because many of us, as we come to practice, is to try to find some way of understanding our own suffering, our own quality of dukkha, understanding this, the path to the end of it. And many of us come because we've tried a lot of other strategies. They just haven't quite worked all the way. Limited success. Now it's interesting to see how many of the Buddhist lists start with this word dukkha. There's last year we spent the whole year on the Four Noble Truths, which starts with the first noble truth. There is dukkha. Then we move into understanding its origination, understanding its cessation, understanding the path leading to the end of dukkha. Then a few years ago, during the pandemic, we explored dependent origination, which also starts from a place of suffering and how that leads into ignorance. And from there, we go into this quality of perpetuating that ignorance through the way we see life in a distorted way. And this year, we're actually going to start also with dukkha and how dukkha can move into wisdom. This is what Chwari will share a little bit about as we explore this transcendental origination. So dukkha is this key word, this key thing that's such a fundamental part of this practice and the way we relate to the world. And the refuges and precepts can be an important piece of how calling us forth to our wisdom of relating to that, relating to the suffering within ourselves, our very personal suffering, the suffering within the world. Because the refuges become this overall perspective, this overall intention, this really guiding force that orients our lives. And the precepts help us not perpetuate our own suffering and those in others. We understand the precepts helps us see how our actions create suffering or how it can help with the release of that. So let's explore that a little bit. So the three refuges of the Buddha, of the Dharma, and the Sangha. This becomes our home base. This becomes our default that we go back to, the core way we relate to life. So on this day, we remind ourselves of that because we often do need that reminding. And we often see when we're really caught in a moment of suffering, in a moment, maybe a life situation, a death, the difficult news in the world, the pain in the world, where's our refuge? Where do we go to escape from that? Where we go to find some place of protection from that. One way is through these three unwholesome roots of greed, hatred, and delusion. You know, we go into the greedy mind or the hatred mind or the checked out, unclear, deluded mind. And we see this so often playing out in the world countless times and in ourselves, how it plays out in the same way. And at the same time, we see how this perpetuates our suffering, that following these three unwholesome roots continues to make that suffering come back. Maybe short term may feel like our suffering is dissipated. Maybe there's a sense of escaping from it. And yet it doesn't get at the root of it, doesn't get at the heart of it. So the refuges offer a different perspective, a different way of meeting the dukkha that arises within ourselves and in the world. And becomes a choice of calling for inspiration, for wisdom, and for community. These three, the triple gem. Now the priests, or the refuges, I should say, there's room for us to find our own way in it, our own place in it. So some of us may feel naturally inclined toward devotion and toward faith, to placing our hopes on something, our energy on something that's bigger than us. It uplifts us, and it gives us a broader perspective. We feel like we're not just doing this alone. While others of us may find we're not so much drawn to faith and devotion and like something maybe more kind of practical, where we can see it right in front of us. And that's also their space in the refuges with this too, the very practical way of how do we practice with our mind? How do we practice with this particular heartache, this moment of grief, this pain in the body, or anywhere in between? So there's space as we go through the refuges to see where is your place in it? You know, maybe you like to bow down and have that sense of devotion. Maybe you like to use it as an inspiration for what is possible in your own life, in your own mind. So the three refuges. So we start with the Buddha, the historical Buddha. You can also think of the Buddha in terms of all that the Buddha represents, all the different manifestations of the Buddha. Here between us we have the Kuan Yin, we have this other seated Buddha, and we have another Buddha in the back that we'll talk about a little bit later. Now, the Buddha started off in some ways in a very well-to-do experience of life. He had all his needs met. He actually was very affluent. There's a sense of caring for all his wants, even before he really wanted them. Also a sheltering from some of the difficulty of life, the difficulty of people getting sick in old age and death, and a way to shelter him from that experience. But yet something inspired him to go forth, to see what is outside of that, because he was deeply shocked when he actually realized that he too was subject to old age, to sickness, and even to death, and wanting to find some way to see through this moment of this experience of dukkha. And this is mirroring off in our own practices, because we could spend today, you know, doing something very different than what we're doing right now. But there's something that's drawn each one of us to be here, to affirm this commitment. How do I relate to my own suffering in a wise way, in a kind way, in a way that doesn't perpetuate my own suffering, that doesn't spread the suffering toward others? Even the possibility of liberation in a deep, very deep, profound way from that. So the Buddha created this path, these teachings, and he continues to be this incredible inspiration for our practice. So the path that he discovered, that he came upon, we call it the Dharma, right? Or the Dhamma, if you prefer the Pali pronunciation. So the Dhamma has such breadth and depth to it. And it's also a little bit of a hologram, that we could pick any one of those teachings and really delve into it and start to see the truth of all the other teachings within that. Or we might want to see the whole picture. And that's why we really love going through some of the traditional teachings as a yearly theme, like the Four Noble Truths, Dependent Origination, the Paramis, and now this year, Transcendental Origination. There's a few different ways of labeling that. So the Dharma is a path that we can read about, we can hear about, but ultimately it's about us walking that path, actually see how does it show up in our lives, in our minds. And meditation gives us this capacity to actually see it for real, to see, does this actually apply to me? Does this actually show up when I hear about someone's death? Does it show up when I'm feeling this terror of what the future might bring? Does it show up when, as I'm parenting my children, as I'm caring for my elderly parents? Where does it show up? How do I actually see the validity of it? And then finally, there's the Sangha. So the Sangha is the like-mindedness, the sense of everyone practicing in a way that's aligned. Because a lot of the stuff we experience as meditators doesn't make a lot of sense in the normal culture. You know, often when I teach retreats, people ask, how do I talk about this experience with my loved ones? And they don't really want to hear about how beautiful the water was going down the fern leaf and how you were transfixed for a half an hour watching that. Yeah. You know, they want to, you know, just say, okay, you're okay. You're not in a cult. All right. That's enough. Right. But to be able to talk to people, you know, have a chance to discuss, this is how I'm meeting my mind. This is how I'm meeting my dukkha, and share with me how you're meeting your dukkha. That builds this cohesiveness of the community, this like-mindedness. So these three refuges, finding your own place in them. What makes sense to you? What makes your heart come alive? Don't feel like you have to be devotional if you're not devotional. Don't feel like you can't be devotional if you're drawn that way. Find that place of home for you. Because this becomes the home you come to when suffering happens, when life falls apart, when life becomes difficult. So we often pair the refuges with the precepts. These two work well together. The refuges come this place of inspiration, this sense of guidance, this place of where we call, what do we call home? The refuges are kind of like a little bit of a reality check, right? If you're, because we have all these ideas, but how does it actually show up in our lives? How does it show up in our actions? Last year, we spent a lot of time on the Eightfold Path, including the middle section, which focused so much on ethical actions, ethical behavior, or virtue. Because dukkha drives so much of our unethical actions. I mean, think of the last time that you told a lie, or you maybe stole something, or maybe you harmed someone. Often it's coming from a place of pain, a place of hurt, or maybe a place of inadequacy, a sense of lack, a sense of scarcity. So remember those three roots of greed, hatred, and delusion often manifest in actions that cause harm. And tonight, we take this commitment toward non-harm toward all beings, including ourselves. Because we see through our practice, we see directly how harm, unethical actions cause harm not only to other people, but also toward ourselves. And they can start to move across like a wave, causing more and more harm. And in the same way, ethical actions, actions coming out of kindness, out of generosity, out of interconnection, also have their own echoes. And it doesn't take much. It's just a sense of awareness of where am I coming from? Which refuge am I choosing in this moment? What actions flow from that? So we can choose to loosen the cycle of suffering for ourselves and others. Now the precepts, the five precepts, are all phrased as undertaking the training to refrain from. Right? Undertaking the training to refrain from. And this is such a beautiful phrase. It's not shalt not or don't ever. It's like undertaking the training to refrain from. And that implies that we do have to be constantly practicing with it. It can be a beautiful practice to take one of these precepts and to really work with it. It may be something I find a little edgy or find difficult. How can I really work with wise speech, with speech that's actually true and not false? How can I work with generosity instead of a place of stealing and taking that which is not freely given? So it becomes a very powerful way to integrate our practice into our lives. And it is a training. It is it needs our constant energy and our awareness, especially when we first start to practice. And ideally, our practice becomes more and more subtle. We start to notice the subtle movement into something that's unethical or something that's untrue or it's causing harm. We start to work with it on that level. Maybe the intention before we actually act. And that way, it's much much less impact in the world and ourselves. And to refrain from these actions. Because each of these actions, it's, you know, there we can say there's sometimes gray area around it. How do I meet these gray areas? And the point is to meet them with a quality of consciousness, a quality of awareness. Now, the precepts that we're going to be sharing tonight that hopefully you all got a copy, and those online will post it so you can see it. We chose a version that has, like I'll read the first one, understanding how intertwined we are. I undertake the training to refrain from killing. I vow to cultivate compassion toward all beings. So understanding how intertwined we are, how interrelated we are. So this is an establishment of wise view. It's also an establishment of the refuges. And where's the refuge comes forth of the Buddha, of the Dharma, of Sangha? And the more the positive expression, I vow to cultivate compassion toward all beings. So the precepts, I love this way of phrasing it, because it both gives us, okay, what's the clear thing not to do, but also what's the clear thing to cultivate, to practice with. And I'll just share the last few, and then we'll move into the actual chanting of them. So understanding how intertwined we are, and undertake the training to refrain from taking that which is not freely given. I vow to practice generosity. Understanding how intertwined we are, I undertake the training to refrain from sexual harm. I vow to cultivate responsibility. Understanding how intertwined we are, I undertake the training to refrain from harmful speech. I vow to cultivate loving speech and deep listening. And finally, understanding how intertwined we are, I undertake the training to refrain from intoxication, which leads to carelessness. I vow to consume items that preserve peace, well-being, and joy. Right? So as I just read those, we'll repeat that. We'll talk more and more about it perhaps tonight, but there'd be a chance for us to actually take these precepts. And as you heard those lists, just notice which ones you're a little bit like, oh, I don't know if I fully like that one. You know, I want to do that, maybe not right now. Maybe that's 2027 would be my year for that one. And just see, okay, maybe that's actually something to turn toward. Can I explore that? Can I feel what that shows up in my heart, my actions? What's the intention with the quality of curiosity, interest? And you might find that in itself starts to transform your relationship with it. All right, so tonight we take the refuges, we take the precepts, but this is something that we bring forth throughout the whole year. All right, so thank you. Okay, so as we get ready to start the ceremony, I have some protection cords here. And could I have about 4 or 5 people volunteer to come up and pass them around the room? Kind of, we can do different quadrants.
One, they're called protection cords because it's said that we're really just taking a thread out of a robe of a monastic and remembering our sort of what Tim is saying, our connection to this practice, that it's not just something random for us, that there's a connection that we have to this practice and to the lineage that has been in existence for thousands of years, that was carried so much by the Asian culture, and then it's here, but it's ours, and yet we want to carry and protect it with the same degree of care. So when we chant this, what we're chanting is our own personal connection with protecting the Dhamma, the Buddha, the Sangha in our own way. There's no, you know, we don't have a list of rules of what it means to protect the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. But there's enough sort of grace to know, and dignity to know, that if you have something that's going to protect you, you're going to care for it on your own, in your own way. And that's what Tim is pointing to. I just wanted to explain the precepts part in English. It's actually Thich Nhat Hanh's group that says understanding how intertwined we are. And he has a longer phrasing. But the actual Pali is that middle section, as Tim was pointing out, the undertaking, the training to refrain from. That's what the Pali is saying. And I like that Thich Nhat Hanh's way of expressing the precepts in English is to add both this vow that we take to refrain from and this positive vow that we're stepping into. And so that's why we put that together with the Pali, which is the I undertake the training. And so I'll just tell you how I think we'll do it. It's pretty quick kind of ceremony, but very important. We always start with the Namo Tassa, what it's called, for those of you that have never done this. It's called Namo Tassa. It's really just like an honoring of the Buddha. And an honoring of the Buddha in however you see the Buddha. You may not see the Buddha as the same way I do, but there is an honoring in the fact that he undertook this training and we all are learning his teaching. So you're honoring him in whatever way that honoring looks at. And it's acknowledging his enlightenment as a noble being. So we say that Namo Tassa three times. We'll say it three times in Pali, and then we'll say it one time in English. And then we move directly into the refuges. We'll say it all the way through in Pali, and then we will say it all the way through in English. So you may not follow the Pali cadence. You might get it pretty quick if you've never chanted this, but it's good to chant the whole thing in Pali and get that cadence and begin to realize it, because we actually chant these refuges and precepts. You request them from a monastic. It's like you formally request them. They will not just chant the refuges and precepts and we just show up and do it like we do here in English. In monastic worlds, you have to formally ask them to give them to you. And that's when they'll do it. And if you ever go on a retreat, we always start retreats with the refuges and precepts. They're very much a part of our lives. Many people, this is their meditative practice, is saying the learning the Pali and the English, and then that is what they chant every morning. Maybe a little bit of quiet, and they chant their refuges and precepts, and they start their day. And so it may be that this is something you take up as your meditation practice. And then when we go to the precepts, we will say the Pali together. It's a little bit more difficult to say the Pali, but you'll see that the words are kind of simple, all of them except for that very last one, which everybody struggles on. And then we'll say the Pali line, and then we'll say directly after the English translation of that. All right, this last bit. Idam Mesilam Magapala Jnanasa Pachayo Ho Tu. That is basically asking into the universe that to allow our saying of these refuges and precepts, may it be so that my efforts bring enlightenment and liberation to me. And then the last part is sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. It's just, it means well spoken. We will say the English to Idam Me Silam, but we won't say the English on sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. We'll just leave it at that. All right. So that's kind of how we'll go. You might want to hold the yarn in your hand here as we say this. You can close your eyes if you want to and just listen to it. I will be saying them, and you can feel into it if you don't want to actually read it. If you don't have, can you close that a little bit there, Tim, or put it on the top so they can... If you don't have a sheet, but I think there's enough sheets. But just in case you want to read it off the screen, you can. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Homage to the Blessed One, the Noble One, the Enlightened One. Buddham saranam gacchami. Dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami. In English? To the Buddha, I go for refuge. To the Dhamma, I go for refuge. To the Sangha, I go for refuge. For the second time, to the Buddha, I go for refuge. To the Dhamma, I go for refuge. To the Sangha, I go for refuge. For the third time, to the Buddha, I go for refuge. To the Dhamma, I go for refuge. To the Sangha, I go for refuge. The precepts? Panatipata veramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Understanding how intertwined we are, I undertake the training to refrain from killing. I vow to cultivate compassion towards all beings. Adina dana veramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Understanding how intertwined we are, I undertake the training to refrain from taking that which is not freely given. I vow to practice generosity. Kame sumachachara veramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Understanding how intertwined we are, I undertake the training to refrain from sexual harm. I vow to cultivate responsibility. Musawada veramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Understanding how intertwined we are, I undertake the training to refrain from harmful speech. I vow to cultivate loving speech and deep listening. Sura mera maja pama datana veramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Understanding how intertwined we are, I undertake the training to refrain from intoxication which leads to carelessness. I vow to consume items that preserve peace, well-being, and joy. Idam me silam magapala jnanasa pachayo hotu. May my conduct be the condition for the attainment of the highest fruits of liberation. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So to help us remember this chanting, this connection that we're taking up with the practice, we're going to tie two knots here. One knot, three knots. We're going to tie one knot, which is your intention, the intention you want to carry with you through this year. Let's take a moment, and then when you're ready, you can tie a knot. Try to help you remember that intention. And tie another knot for the Buddha, to remember that you are going to refuge. You're going to the Buddha for refuge. You're tying a third knot for the Dhamma. And you're going to refuge to the Dhamma. And this fourth knot, and this, we're going to tie one more knot, but really that knot is tied with Sangha. And so for those of you at home, you may be all by yourself and you don't have that seemingly Sangha. So I'd ask you to hold this protection cord until you come upon a friend that you can ask them to tie it upon you, so that there's a sense of that third knot or that fourth knot being tied to a friend who's connected to us. And for those of you in the hall, you can turn to your neighbor and ask them if they would tie your fourth knot for you. Okay. We're going to take a break here in just a second. We'll have some announcements and then we'll take a break.
All right. Thank you, Tori. Thank you all for the wonderful ceremony. And before we take a break, just a couple words about dana. So dana is this Pali word for generosity. And generosity in terms of how you support the Seattle Insight, how you support the teachers, is something that you kind of develop your own relationship with. But I encourage us all to have a relationship with it, because without your support, we can't continue to keep the lights on, to rent this space, to rent the north room, to have the website maintained. All of these things depend upon your generosity. How much you give is really up to you and your own means, but consider having an ongoing relationship with it, maybe having a monthly donation, so it helps us really kind of smooth out the books. And as teachers in this tradition, that's our livelihood, is what you're willing to offer. So this really ties us to this ancient tradition that at the time of the Buddha offered the teachings freely and was supported freely in a generous way. And for 2,600 years, this tradition has been sustained that way. And as we come to the West, we have to learn to translate it, because we're used to having, how much does it cost? What's the fee? How much do I, is it a good deal or not? And we kind of throw that all out the window and let you develop your own relationship with it. And so I encourage you to make dana an alive practice for you, an expression of generosity, of interconnection. And finally, just a couple quick announcements. We have two intro classes starting. One's on the 21st in the East Side with Steve Wilhelm. So it's in Kirkland, right? Kirkland, also online. And then Carrie Peterson is going to be offering one here in this room, also online. That's starting on Thursday, right, the 22nd. In person, online. Yep, in person and also online. Then Carrie and Sean Holmes will be starting a weekly day sit on Wednesdays during the day. It's going to be just in person. It'll be here in the hall from 12 o'clock to 1 o'clock, starting on the 14th. So like next week. Yeah, just next week. Great, so please consider coming. It's called a Still Point Sit. They're going to offer a short talk, have a chance for practice, and a chance to kind of sit in community. And an open space for any questions or responses. And then finally, at the end of this month, January 31st and February 1st, Ronnie Smith, the founding teacher of Seattle Insight, will be offering his final retreat here, the non-residential. It's going to be online only. It's called Merging the Heart Sutra with the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. So it's your last chance to really hear his teaching. So if you're drawn to that, I encourage you to attend. All right, so we'll take a break for 10 minutes.
Maybe five.
5 minutes? Okay, 5 minutes. 5 minutes, and then we'll come back for some discussion around transcendental origination.
So I'm very happy, one, to be here, two, to be here in person. I know, I'm very happy. And then three, that, you know, I'm happy that Tim and I decided years ago when we first started doing we first became the guiding teachers. This was, you know, a good 10 years ago. We decided that rather than each one of us having to figure out something to talk about every time we came in front of the Sangha, that we would do a theme. And we have been doing themes every year ever since then. Yeah, such a... And it's such a great way for the Sangha to feel like Sangha, because every sit you go to is pretty much on the same theme. So if you go to Sunday mornings, if you go to even under 40s or in the evenings on Thursday nights, we all teach from the same topic, and it creates this kind of energetic impulse all around us in this territory. I've become very, very energetic and understanding the energy of Dhamma, that a lot of it carries us, which is what I want to talk about tonight. Transcendental dependent origination is something that Buddha Bhikkhu Bodhi coined. I think he's the one that coined it. He called something that the Buddha would talk about regularly, he called it transcendental dependent origination. So how many of you, if I could see just a show of hands, how many of you know what dependent origination is? Or maybe I should ask, how many of you don't know what that is? That might be a better, yeah, that's a little bit better. Like, I don't know what they are talking about. But it's important to understand what dependent origination is in order to understand this transcendental dependent, I think we're saying arising rather than origination. So let me just do a little step back and tell you a little bit about what dependent origination is. It is basically condition. This conditionality that we live with, this habit energy that we live out of. I have, first time I saw this, I saw it in this, I'm going to tell you this little story. I know I've told it before, but it's so poignant to me that I saw conditionality. And we usually see it in our bad habits. That's where we see it. That thing that we do over and over and over, wish we could stop, and we don't, but we see how much suffering shows up from it. So many of you know I bought this table. I live in this really tiny apartment. I bought this table. It was a glass table. It was round. I looked up online about how do you get furniture for small places, and I don't really have a dining room. It's really one room, but I have a section that I could call a dining room if I had a table in there. So I get this table and I measure every which way but loose. And that table at Fred Meyer's fit. And so I buy this table. And of course it comes in a box. So I unbox it and I put it together. All by myself. And I, or as, my little Pirates of the Caribbean, all by my lonesome. All by me lonesome. I put this together and I put it in the corner where I wanted it to go. And it would not fit. I mean, it was in the corner, but I couldn't get by it. And I was so angry because I had measured. And I was certain this table was going to fit. And I got so angry, I just decided, chuck the whole thing. Just going to take it to Goodwill, see if somebody in my family wants it. I don't want it. I'm just going to go back to holding the space the way I normally had it. Like just my desk area, office area. And my brother happened to come over, who's a carpenter, and he comes over and he's trying to figure out what is wrong with me. And I tell him about the stupid table. And do you want it? I don't want it. It doesn't fit. And he looks at it. And I said, it doesn't fit. I measured, but it doesn't fit. He goes over to the table and he made one quarter turn, slid the table right into the spot. And I remember looking at this table because what it was a round table on the top, but a square base. And I had the base at the diagonal next to the window. He turned it to the straight side, and that was it. Fit right in, no problem. And I'm standing here realizing in that moment that that habit is what I always do. I have this idea, impulse, I decide to do it, I do it my way, I just charge right in, I don't think about anything else or anybody. If it doesn't work, I throw it away and do something else. This kind of repetitive thing that I do over and over and over. And I do it without ever thinking. Just this, get what I want, if it doesn't work, I'm mad, throw it away, do something else. Get what I want, it doesn't work, mad, throw it away, do something else. This is what the Buddha saw in his own life. So be clear about this. The Buddha's awakening was not him seeing the way human life is. The Buddha's awakening was him seeing the way his life was. And as he saw his own life and his own patterns and his own ways of being, then he began to open his mind. And the gift is that the Buddha remembered what he did, what he saw, and then told other people. And he, 2,700 years, comes down to us here at Seattle Insight. So this dependent origination was him seeing the habitual nature of his own conduct over and over and over and over and over. And the more he realized how habitual his own conduct was, he began to realize it's not me, Siddhartha Gautama at the time, it's not me, it is the nature of human to be this way. So it's not Tuareg standing there doing something wrong, it is the nature of our minds to fall into this habitual pattern. And that is why we start the conversation on talking about transcendental dependent arising with dukkha. Because in that moment that I was ready to throw my table away and I saw something, I did not just fall back into the same habitual pattern. The Buddha says when dukkha arises, it has two results. It has the result of more bewilderment, where we fall right back into the same habit patterns, or you take up what he called a noble search. And in that noble search is transcendental dependent arising. And what he saw was that just like dukkha comes from this habitual, conditioned, reactive kind of wheel that we all spin in all day long, every day, he saw that liberation has a wheel also. It's a fractal, just like dukkha's a fractal. And liberation, once you get on that wheel conditionally, it will unfold towards liberation. There's no question to it. There's no, well, but I have ADD. Well, my therapist friend, who's a teacher, Doral Williams, she says, no, Tori, you have ADHD. Okay. I have ADHD. I guess I do have some hyperactivity, a little bit. Tim probably never notices that. But that same, Buddha may not have had that. And yet his mind, my mind, can awaken just like his. Because the awakening process is a fractal. It is conditional. And when conditions are put into place, they lead to liberation, regardless of who you are, who your people are, where you come from. And that liberative path, he has said many times, you do not have to ask for a force of will. You don't have to beg. May my mind be tranquil. He says anyone who has joy, rapture, piti, will have tranquility. It all follows in this same cyclical pattern. So if you could begin to look at that pattern, you could begin to see what are the conditions that we need to put into place in order for the mind to awaken. That is transcendental dependent arising. That's what Bhikkhu Bodhi coined it as. This process of awakening is transcendental. And it starts with a moment of dukkha, because as a Four Noble Truths note, our possibility to awaken starts when we're having some difficulty. Not difficulty because something bad's happening, but difficulty because something good's happening and we want to keep it and we can't. Or you can find the love of your life and you can't really stay with them because you never think they're going to stay with you. You think they're somehow or another going to leave you. And all of that, imagine they're going to leave me, causes what? What? Them to leave you. It's not that something bad happens. It's that we have this mental questioning, dramatic. It's almost like Philip Moffat, my teacher, calls it. It is the tyranny of expectation. The tyranny of expectations. We have so many expectations that we get trapped into those and we can't see our way out. So that's what I was trapped in with my table. It's a fractal. A fractal, if you don't know what a fractal is, it is a pattern that shows up in nature. It shows up all over the place, and it's the same pattern over and over and over and over and over. It doesn't matter how tiny it is. You can look at roses. They can be the little tiny buds, and they look exactly like the big roses. It doesn't matter. It's the same pattern, the same repetitive motion. And in our lives, that's what we're living with, this repetitive motion that we picked up when we were infants and begin to see, begin to hear, begin to watch all these adults, and they're doing that, me too. And we just begin to do it over and over and over and over and over. What the Buddha saw was the way out of that is to begin to see that in the midst of that tyranny of expectation, there is the possibility to find another path. But we have to be willing to take up this noble search and not do my habit energy of just, okay, whatever, toss it out, get something new. So I'm not going to go through all the 12 links that we're going to go through, because we're going to go through them all during the whole year. But I just want to give you a kind of a overview of it. The very first link that starts this moment of dukkha, instead of turning into bewilderment and giving up, you turn towards faith in possibility, in the possibility that there might be another way to deal with this. That's what I was standing there looking at that table, having this moment of realization that there might be another way for me to relate to the things that occur in my life. I don't necessarily have to just chuck it away. I could rethink this. I could have rethought my whole house. It's not that big of a house, but still, I could have changed all kinds of things. I could have put the table anywhere. I didn't have to expect it to go where I wanted it, and if it doesn't, then it failed. It messed up. It's not good. Instead, I could have shifted and turned and rethought. That's what I think my brother did. He is a carpenter, so he saw that. But he also has a mind as a carpenter that sees outside the box. So I've watched him in many cases where he would be stuck and something's not working. Some piece doesn't fit together. Something doesn't work. And I've watched him put on his rock and roll because he loves it and just look at it and keep staring until he figures out another way to do it. That's who he was. That's the way he was always kind of rethinking what he originally thought when it came to construction and carpentry. He could do that with carpentry. All of us can do that with some things in our lives, but there are other places where we don't, and we get stuck in that bewilderment. Faith is what gets us out the door. Faith in the possibility that there might be another way to relate to this. And that faith, if we hold it, will lead to joy. It's a kind of joy that's not like, oh, I can't believe it, I'm so happy. It's not that kind of joy. Once that faith kicks in, or you could call it conviction or trust in the Dhamma, and you stay there, then the natural uplift of possibility begins to come, and we can begin to see alternative ways of relating. And it kicks into this rapture, this kind of, it's like a energy that brightens our ability to stay. Because it means that I'm going to stay and see my own limited view of things, right? I am seeing my own what Buddha called drawbacks. I saw the allure of wanting that table and it doesn't work, and then getting caught in this habit energy. So what we're talking about is you're in a moment when you're seeing a fractal of a habit that is not supportive. You do this all the time. And the joy, the faith, the piti helps you stay with it. Stay with this difficult habit that you see, and don't just fold under the pressure. And instead, you begin to see the possibility that there might be another way to go. See, this is where addicts, those of you that are in recovery, this is where you go. Because in that moment, you could just stumble back into the drug or the alcohol or whatever your addiction is, stumble back in. But there is also this moment where you haven't let go of the addiction totally, and yet you will think that there's another way. And that energy keeps you connected to your recovery. And as long as you have that possibility, you can stay connected to the recovery. So in a way, that faith that leads to joy, that leads to this rapture of energy, is what gets us out of the sort of dukkha cycle, and we move into a different cycle. And in that different cycle, go through what's called tranquility. There's a calm that comes, a happiness that is connected to the present moment. We can begin to get concentrated, and that concentrated mind can begin to help us see the just the unnecessariness or the drawbacks, the limitations of following that other path. That concentration, seeing the drawbacks, the possibility, what the Buddha called the drawbacks and the allure of these other habit patterns. That's this knowledge and vision of things as they are. And we begin to go into this, what's called disenchantment, dispassion, and then ultimately release. So I want to take my last couple of minutes to talk about this disenchantment and this dispassion. Yeah, I'm going to talk about it in 2 minutes. Yeah, 2 minutes of it. Because I have realized in practice that there are two, we're kind of like walking two paths. One path is the path when you're sitting on the cushion. And that disenchantment and that dispassion comes when you finally see, if I just stop dwelling on this story, if I just stop listening to this story, that it no longer entices you to start thinking about it, if I just let it go, you can come back to your object, the breath or whatever, and you can be in the present moment. And that releasing of that thinking mind, releasing of this constant spinning in the story when we're meditating, we begin to let go of all of this, the fantasy and the arguing and the thinking mind that gets so overwhelming in meditation. That's one way to look at this. In your meditative practice, you get less caught up in your thinking mind and you get more interested in the present moment, just as it's arising. But here in this room, practicing in our ordinary lives, we have to be careful that we don't create this idea that disenchantment and dispassion is about turning our backs away from the world, because that's not what it's pointing to. If that's what it was pointing to, Buddha, being totally enlightened, shouldn't have had any dealing with the world. But he dealt with the world all the time. Once he went out and started talking to people, everybody and their brother wanted to find their way to the Buddha to talk to him. Political leaders, politicians, and, you know, wealthy people, it didn't matter. Brahmins. Even Brahmins that were not even going to take up Buddha as a teacher, they would go and talk to him anyway. So there's this way in which, just because he freed his mind from all the obsessions and the tyranny of expectation, it didn't mean that he let go of the world. What he let go of was that tyranny of expectation. What he let go of was this absoluteness that I'm right. Whatever I said, that's the right way. I have that bad. If there's any Virgos out there, we all have to begin to admit that we have a problem with that. It's very difficult. It's not easy, but it's a practice. But that attitude that we walk around with, that has this absoluteness about who I am and what I know and what I believe, and the way that we push it upon everybody, because we think we're right. That is what we let go of. That we get disenchanted with that my way of perceiving everything. And we begin to pull some of the passion out of our has to be just this way. And that opens us to the possibility of seeing all kinds of new ways, different things. It opens us, it releases us into the possibility of, instead of living narrow lives focused only on what we think is right, we live these much broader lives that connect us to the world. And we can see all kinds of views and opinions and all kinds of understandings and ways of doing it that we never thought before. We can begin to make our own little quarter turns in life about all kinds of things that we never thought we'd ever listen to or believe in or even think about. So this is what we're going to look at over the course of this year, is how to set conditions that move us towards this liberation, not in just our meditation practice, but in our ordinary way of living. And we are going to need this. We are going to need some way to believe in the possibility of liberation, even now, when things seem so, like me, standing in front of the table, whatever, chuck it, it didn't work, just get rid of it. You don't have to. In every moment that it feels like everything has gone to hell in a handbag, every moment, there is still the possibility of a noble search and liberation. That same fractal, we can spin into that, just like we can spin into the fractal of discouragement and bewilderment. So that's what we're going to look at. How do we turn with faith towards liberation, no matter what's showing up? Thank you so much. Where's our schedule here? And, yeah, Carrie, come on up. We're going to talk about our special Buddha in the back. Special Buddha in the back.
Okay, so hi, everybody. I'm Carrie, those I haven't met. And just thinking, only Tweri can get us excited about disenchantment. felt like cheering. I'm like, yes, let's do it. Yes. Anyway, I'm really excited for this year and this theme. So before I introduce the being in the back, I need to say also that I am making just a quarter turn shift in my role at Seattle Insight. So just stepping back from the guiding teacher role that I've been inhabiting for the last year plus. And, you know, over the decades, I've been involved in various ways at various levels. And so over this last year, have moved into a guiding teacher role. And I'm now just stepping back from the steering and the administrative, a bit more of the administrative piece, so I can direct my time and energy where I feel like it can be most useful. So I'm still going to be here, not going anywhere, still going to be teaching, supporting people one-on-one, leading under 40, be very involved, just stepping back from some of the work behind the scenes. But it's important to say that because there's an energetic shift around that. And then, very excited to introduce a statue in the back. So online, oh, Tim can do for people online. So this is a statue of Patachara, And this is a gift from Tim, Tuari, and myself. And many of you may know that Patachara was a female who lived at the time of the Buddha. And she came to the path through great grief. So she had lost many family members. She was distraught and inconsolable. So Tuari is talking about going around in circles. She was literally walking around in circles in her grief, unable to find solace. And then she met the Buddha. And anyway, it's, she has a beautiful story, but started practicing when she met the Buddha. The Buddha inspired this faith, this first turning of the alternate possibility. And she started practicing diligently and became awakened. And so many of you know that in the Pali Canon, the Therigatha are verses of awakening from the elder nuns. So she became a nun, and she was one of the first nuns at the time of the Buddha. And her verses, or her awakening poems, are included in the Therigatha. These are utterances that women would proclaim after they experienced a shift. And so we have her utterances there, and we know a little bit about her story. But she also then inspired many other women to follow the path. And that was pretty revolutionary for the time, for a woman to undertake that training and pursue practice full time. So it gives me chills thinking about it. So this is also part of our lineage. This is part of our inheritance. And I was first inspired by this statue in particular, because there's one at the Insight Meditation Center, Gil Fronsdell and Andrea Fellas Center in Northern California. So in that walking room that's next to the main hall, there's a statue that senior Sangha members commissioned for the Sangha many years ago, and I've always been inspired by it. So I researched how they commissioned it, and this was carved by a very talented, skilled carver in Bali, specifically for us. So I kept having images of sitting here and looking at her in the back. And so I'm just delighted that we will get to hopefully be inspired. And remember that awakening takes many forms, many different kinds of bodies, and it always has. So I hope that she is a presence and an inspiration and support for our practice. So from all of us, from all three of us, thank you. Yep.
Oh, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Patachara, and at some point I'll put a little sign, Patachara. She was shipped to, very carefully to my house in Bashan. So it was very intricately wrapped. It was kind of like an unveiling to unwrap her. But and then she was today in my hatchback with the glass table. So, yeah. So that's another story. Good question.
I guess it's just that's where we had decided we had the space. Oh, I should put this in back.
That's where we.
The question was, why is she in the back? And that's the space that we felt was, it was open and it had the greatest amount of seclusion for her, rather than putting her next to the windows or next to the closet doors or trying to find a way up here. It would be too crowded. But there, against that back wall, it's just her. Yeah, that's why. All right, thank you. We have one last thing to do. It's ceremonial. We want to do a chant. Imi Ui wrote a chant, or the Metta chant. And when Tim and I first started doing these refuges and precepts, took them over from Rodney, we used to do this chant at the very end. And then somehow with COVID and stuff, it kind of dropped away, but I really wanted to bring it back and have a sense of this chant being in the space. And so it's kind of a long chant, takes 10 minutes. But what it is, I'm going to read the English version of it while she chants the Pali. And it is a chant that we say on retreat, especially the long retreats, we say it all the time. It's really sending metta way out beyond our thoughts of sending metta to a loved one or regular being. We are sending metta to all kinds of beings. I think that's why it takes a little while. And I'm going to take some liberties to change some of the language because it's a little bit of a problem. But since I'm the only one saying the English, it's my language. So we can start the chant whenever. And maybe if we could lower the lights a little bit, because you're just going to hear it. But can you turn it up also a little bit? May I be free from enmity and danger. May I be free from mental suffering. May I be free from physical suffering. And may I be able to take care of myself happily. May my parents, teachers, relatives, and friends may they be free from enmity and danger. May they be free from mental suffering. May they be free from physical suffering. And may they be able to take care of themselves happily. May all the practitioners in this center be free from enmity and danger. Be free from mental suffering. Be free from physical suffering. And may we all be able to take care of ourselves happily. May our guardian, Devas, as for the monks, may they be free from enmity and danger. All the monastics, may they be free from mental suffering, and may they be free from physical suffering. and may they be able to take care of themselves happily. May the guardian Davis dwelling in this compound, may they be free from enmity and danger. And may they be free from mental suffering and physical suffering. And may they be able to take care of themselves happily. May all the guardian Davis they're missing a whole paragraph. May all the guardian Davis all beings and all creatures, may all individuals and personalities may all beings of all genders, may all noble ones, all worldlings, all deities and all human beings, all those in the four woeful planes, be free from enmity and danger, be free from mental suffering, be free from physical suffering, and may they be able to take care of themselves happily. May all beings be free from all forms of suffering, all wisdom and fortune they have gained not be lost. All that has been attained and gained be received, and all beings are the owners of their own karma. In the eastern direction, in the western direction, in the northern direction and southern direction, in the southeastern direction, in the northwestern direction, in the northeastern direction and in the southwest direction, in the direction below, in the direction above. May all beings, all breathing beings, all creatures, all individuals, and all personalities, and all beings of all genders, all noble ones, all worldlings, all deities, and all human beings, all those in the four woeful planes, be free from danger, be free from mental suffering, be free from physical suffering, and may they be able to take care of themselves happily. May all beings be free from all forms of suffering, all wisdom and fortune they have gained not be lost. All that hasn't been attained and gained be received. All beings are the owners of their karma. As far as the highest plane of existence to as far down as the lowest plane in the entire universe, whatever beings that move on earth, may they be free from enmity and mental suffering, and may they be free from physical suffering and danger. As far as the highest planes of existence, to as far down as the lowest plane, in the entire universe, whatever beings that move on water, may they be free from enmity and mental suffering. May they be free from physical suffering and danger. As far as the highest plane of existence, to as far down as the lowest plane, in the entire universe, whatever beings move on earth, move on the air, may they be free from enmity and mental suffering. May they be free from physical suffering and danger. So that's what we want to dedicate the merit of our practice this year to all beings everywhere.